Entrepreneurs make millions assembling and reselling data about us, much of it from personal information we post online or give up in exchange for airline miles or hotel perks. Our next guest, journalist Adam Tanner, writes about the business of big data for Forbes and other magazines. He's traced data mining back two decades to Caesars Entertainment and its Total Rewards program, which tracks every detail of players' time in its casinos, like the new Horseshoe in Baltimore. Today, Tanner says, American businesses rely on big data from aggregators who sell the most intimate details of our lives to the highest bidders. Adam Tanner on how all this works, big data and the end of privacy, on Midday after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks for joining us for the second hour of our show. On the website of the new Horseshoe Casino in downtown Baltimore, you'll find an offer to sign up for the Caesars Entertainment Total Rewards program. Instead of plunking down cash for chips or dropping coins into a slot machine, you can use a Caesars Rewards card to place your bets, buy a martini if you want, or chow down at the buffet. In return, depending on how much you bet, you'll earn free drinks, gifts, meals, even free hotel rooms and chips. What does Caesars get out of that? Your loyalty, for one, and an astounding amount of information about your gambling and personal habits, which, of course, it uses to entice you to spend even more. Now, loyalty programs aren't new. According to journalist Adam Tanner, they date back more than 120 years. But Caesars, operating as Harrah's in the 1990s, was the first casino to realize there was gold in the data that they collected. In a disturbing new book — I use the word disturbing here, and I'll use the word creepy, too, for some of the stories that we'll hear — the book is called What Stays in Vegas. Adam Tanner describes that city and its newer competitors less as gambling meccas than as a vast data collection machine. They're part of a vast, murky network of players who collect information about us from public and private sources, including marriage and home sale records, police blotters, insurance, hospital credit agencies, video surveillance, social networking sites where we bear our private lives to others. They collect all that. Aggregators spread our information electronically to direct marketers who, like the casinos, use it to target customers. But if Americans are ambivalent about this, you know, this electronic invasion of privacy that we, I guess we all know about, there are others far more dangerous. Amorous videos left on the hard drive of a junked computer can haunt a couple on the internet years later. Adam Tanner describes one website that purportedly helps singles do background checks on possible mates. As a sideline, it posts damaging and often untrue reports and demands cash for their removal. In another case, a woman arrested in a dispute over a $4 restaurant check in 2007 thought her problems were over when the charges were dropped. 5 years later, she found her arrest photo posted on something called BustedMugshots.com, an immensely profitable website run by a convicted felon. Adam Tanner, a longtime bureau chief for the Reuters News Service and now a fellow at Harvard's Institute for Quantitative Social Science, examines this moral gray zone, as he calls it, in What Stays in Vegas, the world of personal data, lifeblood of big business, and the end of privacy as we know it. It's available from the publisher Public Affairs. Adam Tanner, I want to welcome you to Baltimore and the Midday Show on WYPR.
Thanks very much. Good afternoon to you.
Yeah. Adam, it's great to have you. I think we ought to start with Caesars, since, you know, it's the focus of a lot of your book. And we have the new Horseshoe Casino that opened here in Baltimore during the summer. So I mentioned its website, you know, featuring prominently this opportunity to be part of their Total Rewards program. So if I'm a gambler, what do I get out of that? And what does Caesars get out of it? You know, I mentioned it in brief there, but I want to hear more from you on that, about the trade-off here.
So From the casino's perspective, they have a problem if you're promoting a casino in that different casinos offer the same raw product. The slot machines are the same. The tables have the same odds and so on. And so Caesars, as you mentioned, was once called Harrah's, has been collecting data about its customers for many years in order to target to them most effectively. And they're going to offer you all sorts of perks and rewards if you are a loyal player who comes often. Now, many of us know these kinds of programs from supermarket cards, airline cards, and so on. Mm-hmm. In the casino context, you can choose whether or not to join them. Now, if you want to gamble anonymously, you may. But if you gamble anonymously without joining the program, you're not going to get the free rooms, the free drinks, the free meals, and so on that others will get by joining the program. And so the enticement for you to give away this data to allow them to monitor everything you're doing in the public space is this promise of rewards down the line.
You know, I wonder what's wrong with this. So I'm gonna ask you that question. I'm gonna think about it a little bit. All of our listeners are gonna think about this. You go to the supermarket and you buy what you buy at the supermarket, and then you get coupons for more of the same. Usually, that's one thing that happens. And I guess when you go to a casino, they know that you maybe chose the sushi over the Mexican meal or whatever is offered, because there's usually, you know, three or four different restaurants at those Vegas casinos. So I guess I'm wondering what's wrong with that.
So if you're fine with Caesars having that information, there is nothing wrong with that. Typically, the problem comes when you aggregate that information with other pieces of information. Now, in the casino example, Caesars does not sell or share that data with other companies. They keep it only within their walls. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, though, a lot of things we do on the internet or shopping, other kinds of activities, those pieces of information that we share are sold to others. And that's when it becomes more problematic. So a lot of things you buy on the internet, if you go to a site called adamandeve.com, which sells adult videos and toys, they sell that data, so marketers could buy from them a list of women who have bought porn in the last 6 months. You may not have known or expected that, but that's what's happening. Even if you're buying something innocuous, such as clothing, you're giving away your waist size. And if you aggregate that with other pieces of information, it can be revealing about your lifestyle. So that's when you want to be more cautious. So in the Caesars example, you should look at, am I likely to benefit from this program? Are they going to give me things that I want to have? And am I confident that this company is going to keep my data, as they say? And if so, you should join the program. If you have qualms about that, then you shouldn't join. But at least in this case, you have a choice.
Our phone number here for the Midday Show is 410-662-8780. Adam Tanner is our guest in this hour of the show. You're welcome to call in with any question you might have about this. His book is called What Stays in Vegas. I mean, this is a really interesting title chosen for the book because it's about a lot more than Vegas. But let's just talk about Vegas for a minute. So is Vegas really, has it really become what you described, a great data collection mecca? Because all kinds of things happen in Vegas. People get married in Vegas. People do a lot of gambling in Vegas. They spend a lot of money in Vegas.
Well, so data has become, if you think of what the Las Vegas Strip looks like, it's a street with many different casinos on it, all of them fighting for your business. Now, one place has singing gondoliers, the other has dancing fountains, the other has waitresses in Roman togas. But the data is, and the loyalty by offering you special perks is one very powerful way of getting the business. Now, I've looked at Las Vegas in my book, What Stays in Vegas, because there's many different levels of data sophistication that are going on. When marketers gather information about people, one important source they look at first are public records. So in some regards, Las Vegas is a leader in public records. For example, more people are married in Las Vegas than any other city in the United States. And when you marry, you put your address, your phone number, various contacts, relations, and so on. That's then available to anyone in the public, including marketers, to aggregate and put in other forms. So that's one area where Las Vegas is very sophisticated. Another area where Las Vegas also does a considerable amount of data gathering comes in video surveillance. A large casino on the Strip in Las Vegas might have 3,000 or 4,000 or even 5,000 cameras watching what's going on. And they're watching not only the customers who are playing and gambling, but also the staff behind the scenes, because there's ample opportunity for self-enrichment. So the number of casino cameras would be smaller in Baltimore, but it would be true also that you will have hundreds of cameras watching customers and staff behind the scenes. So these are all sorts of areas that are interesting to look at and explore through the world of Las Vegas, and that's what happens in the book.
The history is very interesting. It just so happens, Adam, that over the Thanksgiving holiday, I was telling my son about S&H green stamps and how this was a reward once upon a time. I had to go back a few years to when I was a kid, and my mother would go shopping, and she'd get green stamps, and you'd paste them into a book, and then you could select a gift of some kind if you collected enough stamps. I think we got luggage out of it, or TV dinner trays or something like that. So this idea of rewards has been around for a while, but there's a fellow that you mentioned in your book is really interesting, Gary Loveman. He was the fellow who really made a science out of this. Gary Loveman.
So Gary Loveman is the CEO of Caesars, and he's a character who's very different from those casino bosses of the past. If you think of a typical casino boss from Hollywood, you might think of Bugsy Siegel, or you might think of the character that Robert De Niro played in the movie Casino, yeah, which was based on Lefty Rosenthal. These were figures that had ties to the mob and were kind of rough characters. Gary Loveman comes from a very different background. He's someone who has a PhD in mathematics from MIT. He was then a junior professor at Harvard Business School. And as a business professor, he gained some prominence by the concept of lifetime value of customers by writing about this topic. And the question was, how do you get people to be loyal to your company year after year? In many businesses, you're not that valuable a customer with a one-time purchase. If you go into a pizzeria and you buy a slice or two, you're only worth a few dollars. But if you go week after week over the course of many years, you'll be worth thousands and thousands of dollars. And so he had the idea of, let's gather data about the most important customers, or about customers, and then figure out who are the most important ones to give them that service and make them feel special to keep coming back. Now, you've mentioned a moment ago green stamps, which some of listeners may remember from, you know, decades past. It's already some time before they were in very wide circulation. In that model of loyalty, you would spend $100 at the supermarket. You might get 100 stamps. The problem from the business perspective was you didn't know who the valuable big spenders were until the day they came stacked with green books, ready to get their toaster, or in your case, the luggage or the trays that you got.
Right.
In 1981, American Airlines becomes the first company to introduce the modern loyalty program, and that was the frequent flyer program. Now, up until that time, they had tried to figure out who were their big people flying every week to London, worthy of getting into the lounges and getting special treatment. And they were trying to put together lists based on their numbers, phone numbers and so on, but they weren't consistently getting their customers. And so they decided to offer this reward, the frequent flyer miles and the occasional free flights, in exchange for that information. And that changes the picture considerably, because then you can see, oh, our big spenders who deserve our special attention as a customer, here they are, and we know this from the loyalty program.
So it goes back to my question. It's partly a question for my audience, our listeners here at the Midday Show. Does this bother you? Are you troubled by this? Or are we all getting used to living in this age when, you know, you Google a pair of sneakers and then you decide not to buy them from Amazon, and then, you know, 10 minutes later, the ads for those sneakers or something like it is popping up on your computer screen. Does this bother anybody? The idea of frequent flyer miles, you know, being treated well, or a supermarket that sends coupons to your house for something similar to what you purchased last week? Maybe last week you bought the store brand. This week they want you to buy the brand. Give us a ring if you'd like to join our conversation with Adam Tanner, a journalist and researcher who's written I say disturbing, because it's still, a lot of this is still very creepy to me. And some of the stories we'll hear are downright creepy about the big data industry and what it's done to our privacy, if indeed we have any privacy left. His book is called What Stays in Vegas, The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. The phone number for Midday, 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. And you can send a question by email to, that's midday@wypr.org. Adam will take a short break and come back and talk some more. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here. For me, one of the upshots of this discussion and this book by Adam Tanner, What Stays in Vegas, is that if you thought there was any hope, I guess, of maintaining or maybe even recapturing your privacy, I guess you'll realize the best you can do now is to protect yourself against the worst kind of damage from this big data industry that Adam writes about, that gobbles up information from all kinds of records, public records, our online purchases, and our health insurance, the hospitals that treat us, just about anyone who knows anything that some business would be willing to pay to find out about us, and they do that. And so, Adam Tanner, I want to talk a little bit about brokers, the big data brokers, because they're the next step in this process. Once it's collected, there are some outfits that collect incredible amounts of personal information and sell it to anyone who's willing to pay.
That's right. There's these big companies that typically we don't interact with or don't know about as consumers that have extensive dossiers or files on hundreds of millions of Americans. And the information they might have is where you live, what you're interested in as a consumer, perhaps where you've gone to school, your educational background, maybe where you work, if you have professional licenses, all sorts of things that they can use to target information to you. Now, sometimes that'll result in you getting marketing offers that you might be interested in, but there's all sorts of sensitive categories of information in which there's not really any control about. So these might be things such as religion, politics, sexual orientation, medical condition. And I think a lot of people might be surprised by the amount of information some of these data brokers have. So in my research for this book, I would go to the annual Direct Marketing Association convention and go talk to the various brokers who were offering their catalogs for sale or their items from these catalogs. One list I came across, for example, that surprised me was 1.7 million American men who suffer from erectile dysfunction. And this would be a list that it would have name, address, perhaps phone number and email. And I said to them, can you tell me a little about this list? How did you get these names? And they said, well, these men, they've volunteered this information to us. And I'm thinking, well, you know, 1.7 million men volunteering this information, frankly, I find it hard to believe that even one guy would be volunteering this information. Yeah. And I suggested to them, well, may I propose that I buy a list of 1,000? They were selling for $85 per 1,000 names. I said, well, if you would allow me to buy 1,000 names, I'll send them the following email or letter, and I will say, men, have you received any marketing offers that you found useful related to this reported condition? And secondly, did you know that you were on this mailing list? And the data broker said, well, you know, that would be an immoral use of our data. And they didn't allow me to do it. And unfortunately, that lack of transparency is fairly common about many of the businesses that gather data about us. They're happy to learn lots about us, but when it comes to revealing their practices and even who they are at some of these companies, they're much more shy. And that's something that I think is worth revealing. By the way, that medical ailment is just one of many. You can pick your condition and buy a mailing list for marketing purposes. So if you want people with mental health issues or cancer or many different kinds of lists, it's these kinds of lists are sold. And they're used by many mainstream commercial companies. So this one company that I was mentioning, they count amongst their clients as Procter & Gamble, General Motors, eBay, lots of mainstream companies that we do business with every day.
So there's a retail aspect to this now, because if you can spend, what did you say, $85?
Well, I mean, 1,000 names on this particular list was $85.
Okay.
But the prices vary, yes.
But just listening to you describe what you can buy, what, you know, medical ailments, for instance, if I'm a clinician, a doctor, or I don't know, if I'm selling a product that people need, a medical device of some kind, at the retail level, I mean, it doesn't need to be a big company. It could be a doctor here in Maryland.
Well, of course, the marketing could be useful, and it's best it will get offers to people who are genuinely interested in them. But it would be nice if there was a choice, so that if you were interested in certain kinds of things, that you would declare that interest and have a choice to be on the list. Less, more troublesome, I think, would be if you don't have a choice and don't even realize that you're out there on these kinds of lists. In many cases, they are well targeted, but there's certainly lots of examples of badly targeted advertisement. They may think some things about you that are just completely off base.
Now, the amount of information that's available, I mean, you've been working on this for a while, Adam. You write about big data. You've written about it for Forbes and other magazines. Now you have this book. So I guess this doesn't surprise you anymore. But some people would be surprised at the amount of detail you can get from a dossier on somebody by purchasing information from one of these services.
Well, I mean, as I mentioned, so there's this medical detail. There can be, you know, direct contact details.
Yeah.
Now, you know, there are some companies have used it in clever ways that fall certainly into this grayer zone that you mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast. And so one of the businesses that you cited that I write about in the book are mugshot websites. Mm-hmm. Now, every year in the United States, there's something like 12 or 13 million Americans who are arrested. Only some of those people are actually charged with the crime in the end or actually convicted of the crime. And those arrest photos that are taken, the mugshots, have long been public record information. Anyone could go look up and see those arrest photos. And there's a good reason for that. You don't want people arrested in the middle of the night with no accountability. But some entrepreneurs have seen a business in gathering these photos and putting them online, coding them in the way that when you look up that person's name, you will prominently see these photos. And as these companies started, and the one I look at in particular is called Busted Mugshots, one big source of income was to charge people to take the photo down after they were horrified to see them. And you quickly mentioned the story of Paola Roy, who is someone in the book. She's a woman in South Florida. One mid-afternoon, a friend asked her to meet her for lunch. It was already middle afternoon. She'd already eaten, but she joined a friend just to keep her company. She ordered a small portion of lentils. When the bill came, they charged her for the large portion of lentils. The difference in the price was $3.68. She protested and said she had only ordered the small portion. A dispute ensued, and she left the exact change for the lesser amount and left the restaurant. The restaurant owner called the police, and she was arrested on the charge of defrauding innkeeper. She was sent to prison, and she was 4 or 5 hours in the jail. And then she was released. The charges were dropped. And several years passed before, to her horror, she saw that when you looked up her name on a Google search, you would see her mugshot, even though the charges had been almost immediately dropped. And this was a time that she was looking for a job. So it was a period of some sensitivity. So this kind of business is an example of how you could use personal data in ways that's certainly uncomfortable or distressing.
Well, yeah, that may be a moral gray zone. It sounds like blackmail to me. What's instant checkmate, Adam? Instant checkmate.
So there are sort of two kinds of data brokers. Those used by commercial marketers, and they're companies that you may not have heard of, like Acxiom or Epsilon. And then there are ones that are available to the public as people look up sites. So often when you run ads on the internet for particular names, you may see, when you run searches on the internet, you may see ads for those names saying, look up this person. And Instant Checkmate is a company that has been very successful in generating business as one of these lookup sites. If you want to see whether they have criminal records, where they live, what their phone numbers are, this is a company in that space.
We have to take another break, Adam. We'll come back and talk some more. I've got a couple of emails to read from our listeners for Adam Tanner, author of What Stays in Vegas, The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. If you'd like to join our conversation, that phone number is 410-662-8780. Our conversation with Adam continues in a moment, but first, another quick break as we try to raise the money it takes to bring you Midday every weekday afternoon, 12 to 2. Are you bothered by what Google and Amazon know about you, your online purchasing habits? Does it creep you out? Nancy on Twitter says, yes, it does. I went online to see how many miles before my car needed a new clutch. Car ads popped up for 2 weeks. And then this email from Scott who says, this weekend, my girlfriend was looking at a pair of shoes on the internet. She left the browser window open so that I could see the specific shoes. Several hours later, I opened my Facebook account on my iPhone, and an ad for those same shoes appeared in my feed. the internet really wanted to make sure that I bought her those shoes. So I assume from that, Adam Tanner, that Scott's girlfriend was probably looking at his computer, right?
I don't know exactly, but there's a whole chapter in the book about behavioral advertising where they try to figure out the likely pattern of who's going to buy what kinds of products. Mm-hmm. And that's all of these things that you're talking about where the ad seems to follow you around is a legacy of that. And a lot of us see that where you're looking up a vacation site and then you keep for weeks later hotel offers or flight offers and so on. Now, if you don't like that, there are things that you can do. I have a whole appendix in the book of things that you can install, different kinds of browsers or different kinds of things you can do. It does take a little bit of extra work to boost your privacy. But if you don't like that kind of advertising and you prefer to decide for yourself what products you're looking for and not see the ads, you can do that. It's not that complicated, but takes a little bit of doing. So that's okay. One thing I would mention in this regard.
Adam Tanner, who writes about the business of personal data, big data, his book on this is What Stays in Vegas. It's published by Public Affairs. Let's take a phone call for Adam Tanner here on the Midday Show. Our number 410-662-8780. Adam, Janine is calling from right here in Baltimore. Janine, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dan. I'm a big fan. Thank you.
Great.
It's my first time on the air.
Okay.
Mr. Tanner, I just wanted to know, is there any type of HIPAA violation from people having their information sold to these brokers that you speak about in regards to their medical history? And also, I wanted to know if there's any way for people to find out if their names are on these lists. And that's it, and I can take my answer off the air.
Yeah, HIPAA violation, referring to the federal privacy law on medical information.
So these are both good questions, Janine. HIPAA, as he mentions, does govern the sale or transfer of your personal medical data. Now, if you've somehow volunteered the information, as that's company that I said was having people doing, then it's allowed to be transferred. Now, if you filled out a sweepstakes or some kind of health survey, oftentimes there will be language saying that we can share or use this with others. So you should be careful in filling out those kinds of things to make sure that it's something that won't be shared in a marketing way. But often they will try to entice you in some way, win a discount, win some kind of prize or enter a sweepstakes. That's how they share the data. There's another kind of medical sharing of data that most people do not know about, and it is not covered by HIPAA. When you, for example, go to a pharmacy and you fill a prescription, that information is very often sold about you, but your name is taken out. It's anonymized. It may say a woman of this age and this zip code, and they may link that with other prescriptions and other medical things that you've had done. But that's not covered by HIPAA because it's considered anonymous data. It's considered you don't have a right over it. So an interesting question is, should you have a right to say what happens with your data, even if it's anonymized, even if your name is not on that? And in fact, that's something I'm researching for another book to come up, because the medical data question is particularly complicated. The second part of your question is it possible to find out what's on these lists about us? There is one interesting site that was started a little more than a year ago by the biggest of the data brokers, Axiom. And they set up their own site called aboutthedata.com. And anyone can go on this site and see what they know about you and what your consumer profile is, or at least part of your consumer profile. So you'll have to enter some basic information about yourself, including your Social Security number, which they already know already, and then you can see what they know about you. From several dozen people that I've spoken to who've gone to the site and looked up their profiles, they know a fair amount, but there's also sometimes surprisingly odd omissions or errors. They may say you have 3 children and you have 0. They may say you love to hunt and fish and you've never gone hunting or fishing. But a lot of the stuff they have is correct. So that's, as I said, that's aboutthedata.com, an interesting site to look at. A lot of these companies, though, are not particularly open about what information they have about you. So it's a bit of a dilemma to figure out who they are and what they know about you.
An email from another listener, Mike, who says, when my son was about to go off to college and found out who his roommate was, in addition to Googling the kid, I logged onto a data broker site and found out all kinds of stuff about his family, including the number of homes they owned, the cars they owned, names of his brothers and sisters, and the fact that his father was an attorney who briefly represented the so-called Long Island Lolita. My kids were appalled that I did this. I told them I was only being a responsible dad. But in retrospect, it was kind of creepy. That's an email from Mike. You mentioned... Oh, did you want to comment on that, Adam?
Well, I mean, but Mike is just pointing out the ability that's fairly easy nowadays to find out information about people. And so there's a natural curiosity to find out the information. A lot of the information that he was able to find appears to be based in public records. So where the family lived, you know, who was in the family and so on. So that a lot of that information is easy and it's out there.
You mentioned, you used the word anonymized. Anonymity. What about the right to remain anonymous? You cite the work of this professor named LaTanya Sweeney that I thought was pretty interesting. Could we just talk about that, about her work a little bit?
So LaTanya Sweeney is a brilliant computer scientist who's here at Harvard. And she's shown that many data sets or information about people that's anonymized can be broken. So you may strip out the name or other identifiers about people, but then still be able to figure out who they are. Mm. So in a famous experiment she did already in the late 1990s, she was able to take publicly available hospital exit records and identify the governor of Massachusetts records from that and see what his medical records were. And so this is certainly an issue as we become more and more sophisticated with our computing and as you gather more and more information. So at times it might seem like finding a needle in a haystack, but when you have more and more pieces, it's sort of like a mosaic. A single tile stone might be hard to figure out what the image is about. But when you add multiple pieces of different tiles, eventually the picture comes into focus and you may be able to re-identify. And that's what LaTanya Sweeney has been a pioneer in doing. Incidentally, she's just finished more than a year as the chief technology officer at the Federal Trade Commission in Washington.
You know, I asked you about Instant Checkmate, that website, that background check website that you described. And that brings us to the story. I thought this was an amusing tale of your hunt for the elusive Kristen Bright, who was associated with... Do you mind telling a little bit of that story?
So, as I mentioned before, a lot of companies that gather data about us are themselves particularly opaque. They don't reveal who they are or their backgrounds. And in the case of this company, it was quite hard to find out about them. They did put out statements and press releases from a woman called Kristen Bright. But every time I tried to reach her by phone, by email, by other means, she was not there. The workers hadn't seen her, didn't know who she was. There was a whole mystery about her. And I had really only one clue, which was a Yelp page that had a single picture. And it was a Yelp page for Instant Checkmate. It said, "Hello, I'm Kristen. I'm Kristen B. I love my job at Instant Checkmate." And so it was a woman's face. And I thought it would be quite interesting to see how much I could find out about this one woman just from a photo. And to figure out ultimately, did she work for this company or not? So by sleuthing back and forth, that photo led to another photo that showed this woman wearing a bikini on a boat. More photos revealed she had a real different first name, which was Anne, and she had a surname, which was a fake surname. But going back and forth over time, I was ultimately able to identify who she was and find out all sorts of public information about her. And there was a whole series of interesting photos about her. Some of them were family photos, but there were also some saucy photos that were showing her in bikinis and even topless on occasion. So finally I found her. I called up and asked, and she was quite surprised that anyone had found her. She, in the end, had nothing to do with Instant Checkmate. That was my original question. And in fact, had a flirtation with showing some of these saucy photos earlier on in her marriage with her husband. They thought it was amusing to see what would happen if you put out some saucy photos for the general public. I've sort of given you the PG version of that story, and if you read the book, there's sort of the R-rated version. But it's a good example that with even a very little amount of data, just a single tiny photograph on a Yelp page, I was able to find out quite a bit about this woman.
But you also have excellent reporter journalist instincts, too. I'm not going to spoil the story of Chevy Chase for the audience here, but you did manage to get Chevy Chase's daughter on the phone on Deadline once upon a time when you were a reporter. I think that was back in your Reuters days, wasn't it, Adam?
So this was an example of
You want to tell the story? Okay.
Well, I'll tell the story if you'd like.
We've got like 3 minutes left. Go ahead. Sure.
How you can find most everybody and everyone is impacted. And that was when Gerald Ford died. I was the Reuters bureau chief in San Francisco. I thought it would be interesting to find the actor and comedian Chevy Chase, whose impersonation of Ford on the first season of Saturday Night Live 40 years ago helped define the public impression of the president.
That's right.
And so I went through these data broker files. I found a number that I thought belonged to his wife, and a woman's voice answered, but it was actually Chevy Chase's daughter. And she said, listen, I'm here with my dad. We're actually in Colorado. We're on top of a mountain, and we're skiing. If you wait till we get to the bottom of the mountain, my dad will call you back. And so 30 minutes later, the phone rings. It's Chevy Chase. We have a very nice conversation about the time he spent with Gerald Ford and how genial Gerald Ford was. And I write out the article, send it on the Reuters wire. All was fine. Then at the end of the day, it's the evening, phone rings again, and it's Chevy Chase. And he says to me, listen, I've been thinking about this. How the hell did you get my daughter's cell phone number?
I bet he was mad. And, I bet he was furious.
Well, I mean, because typically a celebrity has agents and bookers and publicists and so on that handle these kinds of things. And I realized in that moment that it didn't matter whether you were a celebrity or a sports star or a judge, a politician. Information is gathered about you and about everyone else. And that's the power of personal data that I'm writing about in What Stays in Vegas.
Adam Tanner, it's been a pleasure to have you on our show today, and congratulations on the book and all this work that you've done exploring this industry, the personal data, big data industry. Adam Tanner, a journalist, is now based at Harvard, where he's a fellow in the Institute for Quantitative Social Science, and he was previously a Nieman Fellow up at Harvard. Adam Tanner's book is What Stays in Vegas, The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. Again, the publisher is Public Affairs. So, Adam, thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thanks very much. And if people want to follow on Twitter, I'm Data Curtin.
Yeah, I noticed that. Data Curtin. Yeah, we've been following you on Twitter as well. So thank you, Adam.
Thanks very much.